Good morning. On today's programme, Hollywood history to go under the hammer and US car workers end 6-week strike. But first we go to India, where a software billionaire's advice to Indians to work for 70 hours a week to transform the nation has triggered a lively debate. Many are opposing Narendra Modi, accusing him of promoting the IT sector's post-lockdown return to office agenda. From India, Sajida Momin reports.
India is all worked up after N.R. Narayan Murthy, billionaire founder of software firm Infosys and father-in-law of British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, advised Indians to work for 70 hours a week if they really want the nation to become rich and powerful. He complained about the country's low work productivity and urged Indians to emulate Germans and Japanese workers who put in very long hours to rebuild their devastated economies from scratch after the Second World War. But Murthy's prescription, which involves working for almost 12 hours daily in a 6-day week, is being vehemently criticised and has found very few backers. Trade unions say it will deepen exploitation of the Indian working class, leading to physical and mental exhaustion and infringement of basic rights. Doctors too have reacted negatively, citing the growing incidence of heart attacks among young professionals who don't have time to exercise or socialise and relax due to long working hours. A cardiologist tweeted that even answering emails and telephone calls after work hours is strenuous and therefore avoidable on health grounds. Murthy's advice also goes against Indian labour laws, which only allow an 8-hour workday, beyond which overtime pay is compulsory. There is already stiff resistance, particularly in South Indian states, to proposals for amending existing rules in order to increase working hours from 8 to 12. Internationally, some countries like Belgium are encouraging industrialists to introduce a 4-day week for workers with pay protection. Britain and Portugal too are contemplating a shorter week with a midweek break and a 3-day weekend to create a more dynamic and productive economy. But some business tycoons have endorsed Murthy's advice, saying that as India is today a rapidly developing nation, there is nothing wrong in Murthy's formula, and if necessary, labour laws should be amended for the greater good. After the coronavirus epidemic, Murthy had mooted a 64-hour week for a few years to make good economic losses. The proposal received a lukewarm response. And last year, another Indian CEO, Shantanu Deshpande, was slammed for advocating that youngsters should start their career by working 18 hours daily for at least 4 to 5 years. His advice to young workers to worship work and stop cribbing was criticised for promoting toxic work culture, which would lead to an early burnout and destroy lives. Deshpande was accused on social media of not even offering to pay extra to those young workers who might somehow consider putting in longer hours. An analyst wrote in the Hindu newspaper that Murthy made those remarks to help software companies which want to replace work from anywhere, which was prevalent during the lockdown, to work from office. In that sense, the billionaire clearly wants to set the clocks back to pre-pandemic times when work was synonymous with going to an office. The return to office agenda of Indian firms has its pitfalls, though. Some studies have shown that work from home not only saved costs for companies, but improved worker output. The United States, for instance, witnessed an increase in productivity since the pandemic as an increasing number of Americans worked from home. But Murthy obviously wants employees to be back in the office and spend longer hours at their desk. And he seems to be particularly concerned about increasing the productivity of IT companies. There is no shift system in these firms, and the same team is expected to work in the development of a software product from the beginning to the completion of the project. Hence, increasing working hours is necessary for increasing the productivity and profitability of an IT company. Avijit Pathak, one of India's foremost sociologists, says that instead of lecturing Indians to work for 70 hours a week, Murthy should look at the huge discrepancy in the salary structure of leading corporate houses in India. Calling the discrepancy structural violence, Pathak pointed out that even in 2023, people starting out in their careers at Infosys, the software firm Murthy co-founded, are paid 372,000 rupees, the equivalent of 4,200 euros annually, while the CEO draws 2,200 times more than their pay. According to Pathak, if Murthy is genuinely interested in economic prosperity, he should straighten up the fundamentals first. For World Report, this is Sajda Momin in India.
To England next, and an auction of film and television memorabilia will take place in London this week, which includes costumes and props from the movie Titanic and the science fiction series Star Wars. The items on sale are expected to be sought after by movie fans, and the event will once again highlight our fascination with the history of Hollywood. Russell Padmore reports from London.
There is a thriving market for props which featured in movies or costumes worn by actors in film and television productions. The annual auction in London this week by Prop Store is expected to raise more than £12 million, about €14 million, from the sale of iconic items used by the industry. 1,800 things will go under the hammer. Star Wars fans could bid for the head of the robot C-3PO, or those who like drama could try to buy the clothing worn by Leonardo DiCaprio in the film Titanic. Spoiler alert, the shirt, waistcoat and trousers worn by DiCaprio are likely to have been immersed in icy water. Still interested? Then you'll need to empty your bank account, as the predicted sale price is between £100,000 and £200,000, about €230,000. Cheaper items of clothing going under the hammer include a bathroom robe worn by Ursula Andress in the James Bond movie Dr. No, and Johnny Depp's stunt costume from Pirates of the Caribbean. You could pick up those for less than £100,000. If you think that's an expensive price tag for old clothing, then your wallet or purse may not contain enough money to buy the head of the C-3PO robot from Star Wars. That iconic piece of Hollywood science fiction has an estimated sale price of £1 million. When production is finished, costumes and props can be stored in a warehouse owned by the studio, perhaps to be used in another film, or they're given to the actor who wore them. Sometimes they're donated to museums, but it's common for them to be sold in an auction. Hollywood experts say everybody has one or two movies or television series that they connect to. We may still have a toy from our childhood that was sold as merchandise linked to a film. But for many, having a replica product is not the same as owning the original rare item as seen on the screen. This week's auction by Prop Store here in London features the whip used by Harrison Ford's character Indiana Jones, which might set you back £200,000. But the shooting script from the movie The Shining, with handwritten notes by the director Stanley Kubrick, may be more affordable at £30,000. Cheaper again, the sneakers worn by Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump, the starting price €17,000. Collectors might see the items as an investment to be sold at a future auction. The auction house Bonham says vintage movie posters of American, British, Dutch, French and Swedish films are continually in demand. I recall a visit to a small museum in Rosnalla in County Donegal, where I saw a faded Irish Army officer's uniform worn during the 1920s. Contrast that real-life historic artefact, with seemingly no monetary value, with a costume uniform worn by Liam Neeson in the film Michael Collins. Just a few years ago, Bonhams auctioned it in London for almost €4,000, 10 times its estimated sale price. In some cases, items from Hollywood's version of history may be more valuable than artifacts from our real past. Here's another example. Last year, an extremely rare copy of the 1916 Proclamation of the Irish Republic was sold for €170,000. In 2015, the dress worn by Judy Garland's character, Dorothy, in The Wizard of Oz, was sold for more than €2 million. This digital age of streaming movies online or watching multi-channel satellite and cable television, many of us seem to be obsessed by film memorabilia, more so than real-life history. I recall a survey of students in Texas a few years ago which revealed few of them knew which side won the American Civil War, but most could name the cast of the television show Jersey Shore, as well as following developments in Brad Pitt's marriage. The enthusiasm for film and television memorabilia might provide a social lesson for analysis by experts. This week, Prop Store's annual auction of film props and costumes may make you an offer you can't refuse, a coat worn by Marlon Brando in The Godfather. I'm Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
Finally, to the United States, and after more than a month on strike, American auto workers and the so-called Big Three US car makers have reached tentative deals to end the work stoppage. If ratified by union members, workers would receive a 25% pay rise over 4 years, a cost of living adjustment, and the right to unionise at battery plants. From Washington, AJ Mai reports.
Last year, electric vehicles accounted for 11% of all passenger and light truck vehicles sold in Europe, and 6% in the US, respectively. Car manufacturers such as General Motors, Toyota, and Volkswagen are investing heavily in electrifying their fleets. Global automakers will invest over $1 trillion in EVs and batteries until the end of the decade. Of the more than 1.5 million EVs sold in Europe last year, Chinese brands accounted for about 5%. This figure is expected to grow even more in the coming years as Chinese car makers are continuing to expand their presence in Europe. Short Janssen is an IT manager in the Danish capital of Copenhagen. He and his wife decided to buy a Chinese-made BYD this summer. Their decision was simply an economic one. The BYD model was 20% cheaper than the offer from Volvo, which, somewhat ironically, is also Chinese-owned. Geely bought Volvo cars in 2010 for $1.8 billion. Janssen said the cheaper price in combination with tax credits and some freebies such as free charging for 2 years and a set of winter tires was simply too hard to resist. And he's not alone. The European Union expects that China's share of EV sales will rise to 15% by 2025. And while the electrification of the transportation sector is a priority for the EU, it recently launched an investigation into China's alleged unfair trade practices. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen announced a probe in September, claiming that Chinese companies are able to keep their prices artificially low due to huge state subsidies. The outcome of the investigation, which could take up to 13 months, determines whether the EU will impose additional tariffs above the standard 10%. Beijing has pushed back against the probe, calling it blatant protectionism. China's rise as a hub for EV production has been incentivized by its central government through subsidies, tax breaks, and relaxed regulations. This focus on the electrification of cars has spurred a slew of new EV-only car producers in China, including BYD, NIO, or MG, and they are now competing with European and American brands. China's EV market has already surpassed the initial adoption phase and entered the mass market stage. More than a fifth of all car sales in China are fully electric, putting the country among the top five globally with regard to EV penetration. And after making inroads in Europe, many Chinese EV makers see the North American market as the next frontier. That's despite a tense geopolitical climate and new US laws, like the Inflation Reduction Act, which are designed to promote homegrown American production. But the US cannot transform its auto industry without China, at least not in the short term, says Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is because of China's dominance in the mining and processing of raw materials, such as rare earths, which are key components in EV batteries. About 80% of the minerals needed for the green transition are processed in China. And even though Chinese EV makers have yet to gain any significant foothold in the US, lawmakers in Washington are already wary of the Chinese Communist Party's plans. Trump-era tariffs of 27.5% are one reason why Chinese EV makers have yet to enter the US market. But as the US EV market matures, there will be more opportunities for foreign brands to compete. This year, US EV sales are on track to surpass the 1 million mark for the first time. In the third quarter of 2023, EV sales accounted for 7.9% of all car sales in the US. That's a new record. And with more models and charging infrastructure entering the market, the growth is expected to continue. Kennedy calls for a transformation of the U.S. auto sector that goes beyond protectionist measures from Washington. But Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, who serves as the chairman of the House Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the U.S. and China, calls for strategic decoupling from China in the auto sector. The current challenge posed by upstart Chinese companies to traditional European car brands could provide some guidance for any U.S. regulatory intervention. But Detroit's Big Three have to accelerate their transition toward EVs, or risk being left behind. For World Report, this is HJMI in Washington.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Sharon Lynch, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.